We are working our way through the literature of the Bible, looking at the qualities of good literature and the features that are found not only in the Bible but other sources as well, movies, television shows, or whatever it happens to be. So we looked at the value of literature a while back, talked about stories as far as setting and characters go. Those are the last two MP3s that we've been doing. And this time we're looking at plot. Now, plot is the key thing, of course, that most people look at stories for. I would say those that are interested in escapist kind of reading, the what we would call, I guess, the beach reading, where you just kind of waste time and enjoy a good book and then toss it later, give it to a friend or something. But this would involve a lot of emphasis on plot. I think good quality literature certainly has plot, but setting plays a bigger role. The characterization is hugely important. Thematically, there's some things going on there as well. But so we're looking at plot, something all good stories would share. Plot are the sequence of events that are happening in the story, usually put together with a very careful design. For example, I wanted to use the Book of Ruth. And if we kind of walk our way through Ruth and then come back and do some specific things as far as plot goes, you'll see what I'm talking about. A typical plot involves some kind of distress early in the story, some sort of problem. And then the problem usually gets worse, and then there's got to be some kind of turning point, and then some kind of resolution to this problem. I mean, that's just typical for all stories. So if we take a look at the Book of Ruth, we start off, I would call it like Act 1, we get some background and what's going on with the story with Naomi and Ruth. And Naomi is living let me back it up here. So they go and live in Moab, she and her husband. And her name is Naomi, the wife. The husband dies, the sons die. And now Naomi is bereft of a husband and two sons, and she's living in a land that's not hers, land of Moab, close to Israel, but not connected with the Israelites. So that's a terrible start to the story, isn't it? And she doesn't know what to do. She's got to go back to the land and try to make a connection, you know, with the people of Israel. And she's got these two daughters-in-law. One of the daughters-in-law says, "I will stay with you," and one leaves. And so the daughter-in-law of Ruth is the one who stays and has this famous expression or this famous statement here in verse 16 of chapter 1. "Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God." What I think is interesting is they've taken that tune and they've turned it into a wedding song, an old wedding song. But it didn't really have anything to do with clinging to somebody of the opposite sex. This is Ruth, who's lost her husband. She's a Moabite woman, but she's willing to go with Naomi. She honors Naomi and says, "I'll go to your land. I'll go to Israel with you." So there's Act 1. The problem has come, and they're setting out to the land. Toward the end of chapter 1, we get, I would call Act 2, look at verse 19. So, they do. They leave the land of Moab, they come back to Bethlehem, and the whole town says, "Wow, here's Naomi." And look how deep Naomi has gotten. She said, "Don't call me Naomi." And that means pleasant. It's a very positive one. "Call me Mara," which means bitter. So her life is terrible right now. "The Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me." And so they come back from Moab, and that's the way that little scene ends. They're arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was about to begin. By the way, there's much here about fertility and harvesting, kind of an interesting subtext happening as well. So there's the second act. They've had this disaster, they've come back to the land, and now things don't turn around. In fact, Naomi is sunk in despair at this point with Ruth. And the two of them are back, but they've got nothing. I mean, remember, this is way before any kind of social welfare programs. If you lost your husband, if you lost your means of support, you were totally on your own and in deep trouble in this society. But Act 3 comes about now. Somebody new is introduced. very quickly in the first verse of chapter 2, Naomi had a relative. Oh, okay, here's a little glimpse of hope. If you're on your own, you're in trouble, but maybe there'll be a relative that could help. And his name is Boaz. And so Ruth goes to work in his fields, which is a little longer scene here, a little more complex scene, but she goes and he's very kind to her. And so it looks like maybe some things will be better off for them at this point. And that's basically all of chapter 2, the meeting with Boaz. And look at verse 20 of chapter 2. Naomi finds out Ruth is working with Boaz in his fields. And she says, "The Lord bless him. He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead." Oh, so there really is hope. She says, "That man is our close relative. He's one of our kinsmen redeemers." So there's a case where we're talking in a way setting just as well as we are plot here, because we want to know what the cultural significance is of somebody named a kinsman redeemer. In their culture, this was somebody who was responsible for needy members of an extended family. And so if a relative, for example, had sold himself or herself into slavery for a while to pay off debts, this kinsman redeemer, if he or she had enough money, could come along and get that person out. They could also redeem land that a poor relative had sold. They could take care of an avenged killing of a relative. So this is an important person. You find out that this Boaz is the closest relative. He will be one of their kinsmen redeemers, possibly. So do you see the glimmer of light that's showing here? So Act 3, good news. Things are switching. Things are turning a little bit for Ruth and Naomi. And then the next act is a strange plan that's put into effect. So do you notice every scene is building on every other scene? So first the disaster, they come back to the land. Naomi is just crushed. Chapter 3, there's a brief light that's opening. But what does this mean? What, this man is a relative, but will he actually do anything for them? And so a plan is put into effect to see if he will actually help them out or not. And I will skip over the whole plan. Again, it's probably important that you do some examining of their culture to figure out what was going on there. But basically, Ruth throws herself at Boaz in a good way to say, "I'm totally helpless. I need you." And let's see. He gives her some barley in verse 15 of chapter 3, and she comes back to Naomi, and Naomi's on pins and needles, right? She's put this plan into effect. How did it go? And Naomi says, "Well, he gave me some barley, and you know, don't go back empty-handed." So it's a very good sign. Something is happening here, positive. And so verse 18 in the chapter, Naomi says, "Well, he won't rest until the matter is settled today." So the matter is going to be settled, and that's what's going to happen in the last section of the story. It looks positive, and now comes the resolution. And what happens is Boaz goes to the town, he's in public, and he agrees to redeem the situation with Naomi and Boaz. Boaz says, verse 9, chapter 5, "Today you are witnesses. I have bought from Naomi all the property of these people. I have acquired Ruth the Moabitess as my wife." So he is not only going to help them out financially, but he's actually going to help them out with their situation in the society. He will marry this woman. And so things are going to turn out really well. In verse 11, we get kind of a chorus speaking here. "We are witnesses, say the elders. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel." So we trust everything will work out. And then the, what would you call it, the postlude or the postscript to the story is they do become husband and wife, Boaz and Ruth. And at the end, the little twist or the surprise is they have a son named Obed who becomes the grandfather of, ta-da, David. So that's pretty neat ending to this story. That's a great bit of plot going on there. Huge problems, possibility of a solution, a plan is put into effect, and it all works out at the end of the story. Now that's a positive story, of course, but negative stories do that as well. Disaster comes and everything comes crashing down at the end. But how important is plot? in a story huge, obviously. And one key element of plot has always been conflict, one kind or another. And I'm going to suggest three kinds of conflict, and we see them not just in the Bible, and that's the whole point of this. As we talk about literature, the Bible is a piece of literary work, and it deserves and it does follow the same standards that we're talking about for all good literature. So here are the three kinds of conflict that we encounter in stories. One, obviously, is a physical conflict. Person against person, and there's a physical something going on there. I always think of course, David and Goliath, good example. Definitely a physical conflict going on there. Well, that's pretty obvious, so we'll go on. There are plenty of other biblical stories of physical conflicts, but what about conflict between characters? One character against another character. Not necessarily fighting, but maybe a clash of cultures, a clash of wills, a clash of worldviews. In this case, how about Ahab and Elijah? Ahab has lost his belief, has messed around with other non-Judaic customs and all, married a Philistine woman. And then you got Elijah representing the God of the Old Testament, and the two of them are going to clash. How about Jesus? Does he clash with the people of his society, character against character? You bet. How about Jacob and Esau? Oh yes, big, big clash there. And then a third one, which I think is one of the more interesting types, especially when it comes to the Bible, is there are often moral and spiritual clashes, aren't there? You think about Abraham, the clash with his society and the clash with the way he wants to treat God or how God wants to treat him. Moses has that. So lots of different kinds of conflict can mean a lot. Well, what do good stories need? They have to have conflict, but they better have suspense. They don't want to make things happen too quickly, do they? Somebody said once, talking about stories, make them laugh, make them weep, make them wait. And I think that's a good point. Suspense. You can't have things happen too quickly. Keep the reader suspended for a while. Think about Moses. We get quite a bit before Moses actually goes to Pharaoh, and even the back and forth with Pharaoh, it takes 10 different plagues on the house before he lets the people go, and even then Pharaoh changes his mind and chases after the people. So that's a long stretched bit of suspense there. How about David? He's promised the kingdom. How does that go? Not so well. It's stretched out for a long period of time. About the story of Jesus. He comes, he starts clashing. First he comes and reveals himself and people feel good about him, but gradually he steps on more and more toes and more people get upset at him until finally, as you know, the plot is put into effect to actually put him to death. How about Esther? Boy, you talk about suspense. If you haven't read the story of Esther, I won't spoil it, but we have a king in a land, in Persia, in a land that has no interest in the Jews and decides the Jews have got to go, we're going to put a pogrom into effect here, and her job is to save her people, but it's stretched out over a little period of time there. It doesn't happen just in a few verses. Let's talk about something else that we often encounter in good plots. It's called poetic justice. And poetic justice means the good get what they deserve and the bad get what they deserve. The Bible is actually one big example of poetic justice, isn't it? Things turn out okay at the end for the good people. Things turn out not so okay for those that deserve punishment. But we see that a lot in here. Poetic justice. How about Absalom? He raises his hand against David, his father, the king. Overthrows what God wants, because David was the one who was anointed, not Absalom. And then Absalom comes down to a pretty terrible death. Ahab dies a terrible death. Samson dies. Judas dies. Haman. Let's go back one more time. We've talked about the book of Esther. Haman is the bad guy in the book of Esther. He's the one who's anti-Semitic. He wants to put the Jews to death. He is so excited about it. He's helping construct and plan how their death should occur, and who dies at the end of the story? Haman. So poetic justice is a nice feature of stories to say, well, good. Good people get some kind of reward and evil people get punished. I would just say a lot of modern literature has gotten away from that because a lot of modern authors don't see any rhyme or reason to this world. They see it as a place of chaos, a place of no purpose whatsoever. It's cosmic craziness. So the good get punished and the evil often get away with things. But the Bible has a lot of poetic justice in here. Let's talk about a typical plot that you can encounter. One kind that's so typical, all kinds of literature have what are called transformational plots. And what I mean by that is you can have a transformation, two types really. You can transform your fortune, which means things get better for you or things get worse for you. Or you can have a transformation that's internal. The character himself or herself is transformed in some way. Let's take a look for a minute at the transformation of fortune characters. People who start out high and end up low. So it's sort of a crash of fortune. Think about Adam. Created perfect, created in the perfect world, created with a perfect wife. He's got a perfect job, close connection with God, and it all goes bad. That's a huge transformation of fortune. About the kingship of Saul. Starts off, he's anointed, big, strong, strapping guy. He's got Samuel to help guide him, and it all comes down on Mount Gilboa by the end of the story. He's dead. His sons are dead. Terrible drop. We will talk later about kinds of stories. This would be considered a tragedy. Somebody of noble estate coming down to such a terrible depth of despair. But we have things that end up harsh at the beginning and end up okay at the end. We just read one, the book of Ruth. Right? It starts off terrible. Ruth's lost her husband. Naomi's lost her husband, her sons. And it all ends up all right. There's a transformation of fortune. The story of Jesus, put to death, and the resurrection at the end of the story. Things turned out all right. Esther, she takes a chance and things turn out okay for her, and the Jews are saved. So there's one kind of transformation story, fortune. What about transformation of character? Well, we've seen a lot of those. How about the characters that turn their lives around and end up better at the end than they were at the beginning? Can you think of a few in the Bible? Sure, a lot of them. Let's take one, Jacob, the deceiver, right? But he ends up getting his name changed and becomes closer to God. New Testament, how about Paul? Talk about a transformed character. A Christian hater, a Christian persecutor, turns out to be the most famous missionary in the history of the Christian church. Wrote several letters that showed up in the New Testament. Well, some characters, unfortunately, start off okay and they degenerate as the story goes on. Solomon, Samson, or some. Then you have some, I guess you'd call it a transformation, but they'll have a revelation or an epiphany as they go about their story. Job, for example, he's transformed, isn't he, by this revelation at the end of the story. Finally says, I'm not going to say anything else. God's revealed himself. David and Bathsheba, he has a revelation coming to him about how awful he has been, and he has to make it good, and is going to have all sorts of suffering in his family as a result. Those are just a few things to think about when you're looking at stories. Consider the importance of plot. Obviously, it's hugely important. Look at the conflict. Note what the clash is about. Who's fighting whom? Look for suspense. How are they able to stretch the story out in a good way, right? A way that makes you want to read for further things. They'll move the story along, but it'll be very slow. Look for poetic justice. If you don't see any poetic justice, that's probably saying something about the author's worldview, that the world is basically a hostile or indifferent place. But people who think there's a theistic person, there's some sort of God beyond this life that maybe things tend to work out better. Look for how scenes and episodes are handled. There's selectivity in these stories. We didn't really touch on that, but think about that for a minute, how in a plot, it's often short pictures of things that are put together. It's not one long episode or one long story. They're broken into smaller chunks. Look at the life of Jesus. He goes and he heals somebody. He gives a sermon. He interacts with Pharisees. He talks to disciples. But this is not really seen as one long story. It's little pictures, almost like a TV show episode. And then you look for the kinds of plots that dominate. So many of them involve some transformation, either the person's outer part, which would be their fortune, or the inner part, character. Notice the changes that take place as these stories go on. Okay, so that's a quick look at plot. Next time we're going to look at theme. What's the story trying to say?